tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 472 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Crocodile.
Good evening.
And returning after a long hiatus, BB Boy 20.
It just keeps tumbling down, tumbling down, tumbling down.
What is that from? I don't recognize that.
I can't remember the name of the song, but...
Yeah, Seda had a last-minute work emergency, so he's not going to be on this episode. So just letting you know now. But yeah, BB Boy and Crocodile, welcome. Let's go ahead and start off with the news like we normally do. And there are like two pieces. The first one I'll talk about, which is we learned during some of the interstitials and stuff this week that next week, this weekend, this coming weekend, that apparently Toonami is doing some kind of cross promotion with the new upcoming Mortal Kombat 2 movie.
It's all Warner Brothers, so it makes sense.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because Mortal Kombat's owned by Warner Brothers. Cartoon Network's owned by Warner Brothers, so...
I guess I didn't put that together. I didn't know who owned Mortal Kombat. But yeah, it's weird hearing that there's a Mortal Kombat 2 movie coming out, like, soon.
I think the first one, first one of this new series, timeline, production, whatever you want to call it. I think it did decently well in the box office. I never saw it myself, but my recollection was that it was mostly people liked it generally, and it, I think, did good enough numbers. So obviously it was a sequel. Hopefully it's better than Annihilation many years past, which is an abomination, in case you ever saw that.
No.
That classic Mortal Kombat movie was really good, but then Annihilation was abomination.
Yeah, I mean, as corny as it was, I thought the original one that came out back in the 90s or whatever was all right, but...
No, it's pretty good, like, you know, for a video game movie, It's pretty good. It's just, they made the Annihilation sequel, and that was just unmitigated trash, but...
Also, this is coming out, and then there's a new Street Fighter movie coming out. It's like a bunch of fighting game movies coming out. It's interesting.
Waiting for the Guilty Gear movie.
Well, they already did that show. The anime last year, I think.
Yeah, I think it was Duel something another, because that introduced Unica, right? I forget, Duel Masters or something. But That was like a 3 anime animation. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, so look forward to that this weekend. I'm sure it's just going to be like an extended trailer or something, so whatever, that's cool. Make that money. And then, Crocodile, you did also want to mention one other thing.
Yeah, I just came across it. I think saw someone posting a thread. Common Side Effects actually won a Peabody Award in entertainment department, or category rather. It was allegedly the first winner in that category from Adult Swim since Boondocks back in 2006. And it's a rare animated series to win for that category. So like we all know, Common Side Effects is great. It was our winner of Show of the Year last year. It keeps getting these accolades, and I think it's pretty much well deserved. So
it'll be pretty much a foregone conclusion now. We're going to get a continuation of that series, I'd have to assume. I mean,
I thought they already announced it. Wasn't it already confirmed for season 2?
I don't remember that. If so, I hope so.
That was my recollection, but I guess I'd have to look it up.
So yeah, Common Side Effects continuing to do amazing in awards and being recognized. 20 years between the last time an Adult Swim show won that award, and now, I think it's totally worth it. Like you said, it was our show of the year last year, which is, again, we've talked about a million times how it's like not even a show that was intended for Toonami, but it's so good that it won. Okay. Well, that's all we have for news this week. So let's go into the rundown. And of course, we're going to begin with Rooster Fighter.
Something's broken.
That's probably for the ground. Do you look at it? Do you hear it? Look at me. Don't think so. Let's jump into it. Cup, 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 cup. Are you ready? Cup, 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 cup. Now let's go. Cup, 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 cup. Are you ready? Cup,
Rooster Fighter Episode 7, Crowing Over a Feather. I didn't think about this one before I read it. Crowing Over a Feather. I don't know. I'll have to think about that one. Anyway, the episode starts out and we're seeing sort of a flashback nightmare that Keiji's having back to when his sister was, you know, had gained her power, and well, as well as when she was kidnapped or taken.
When she got Magician's Red.
Yeah. After he wakes up, a whole bunch of what I wrote down are pigeon fanboys come to meet Keiji and want him to go on them. These two pigeons want him to go on them for a triple date.
I think they mentioned that there was a third carrier pigeon who was with them, but he got a call to, you know, I assume do carrier pigeon things, make deliveries. And so they needed another man for the triple date. Of course, they just saw Keiji. It was like they recognized, I think they saw Elizabeth first and recognized the group of them was the famous demon hunting chickens on the, they said they were following the matter on the humans' phones. So probably on the YouTube, whatever the equivalent of YouTube is on that universe. And then so they were hesitant to ask Keiji because it was like, why would we ask our hero out for doing us this favor? But he asked anyway, and I think Elizabeth talked Keiji into doing it because she thought it would be fun.
Yeah, yeah. And so Keiji goes to on the triple date, and at first the female pigeons are unimpressed. They're like, oh, he's just a chicken, he's a rooster, they're lame, blah blah blah, he can't even fly. And Keiji gets really kind of shot to his ego and stuff, and he gets really mad, and then he's just like, screw this, I don't care about this, why am I even bothering? And then that's when like the girls sort of like see, oh, he's got that tough side, and they kind of fall for him then.
Yeah, he flips the table, walks away, then you do like the painter frame or whatever. I forget that what that frame freeze is called, but that, you know, the when they got the paintery style, all the cool bad boy posing, and that's like, oh, he's such a bad boy, and then all the lady pigeons that were trashing on chickens just moments ago were all swooning over him at that point. Hard to get, I guess, in their eyes.
Yeah, and Elizabeth gets a little jealous of this, and she's like, oh, you don't really know what this guy's like. He's a real jerk. And anyway, they end up leaving.
I think she called him a man whore, and then I think the whore part was bleated out.
Oh.
Was that, did I correctly? It's like man.
Probably.
Bleep, bleep. And I think it was man whore I heard through there, but I think it was just to insinuate that KG is not especially faithful, which is kind of true, because he kind of has the wanderlust, so to speak. And I think that also was a turnoff to the pigeons.
Yeah. But before we get to the commercial break, and Pyoko's there as well, and then Pyoko kind of falls, and then that green-eyed woman that we saw at the end of the last episode is there. She kind of catches Pyoko and is like, oh, you need to be careful. Be very careful with this one. And then she walks away.
Yeah, very subtle foreshadowing. I think Pyoko was trying to defend Keiji's honor because she was upset that Elizabeth kind of ruined that whole event. And Elizabeth herself was like, what was I thinking? What, that was a dumb thing to do. And then so Pyoko was letting her have it. And then that's when Pyoko fell over. And then this mysterious woman, you know, was all foreshadowy. And then Keiji was like, what's up with this weird-ass woman? And then, as you say.
Yeah, well, before we continue, what is up with this woman? Like, she was kind of nice in this moment. That's weird.
I mean, I think we can loop back. I mean, there's more to this, I think, in the ending part of the episode, which you're about to go to. And I think once we talk about that, we can loop back onto here, because I think this is foreshadowing some stuff that later in the episode pretty much lays out explicitly.
Okay. All right. We come back, and we see this other rooster whose father is being held hostage by some demons. And this rooster's name is Kisuke. And his, they're kind of like, you know, being really rough with him. And he ends up escaping and he's like, I got to get out of here. And he runs away and he vows that he's going to come back and save his father.
Running to get help.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to point out here is that these demons who are harassing his father, if you look at, you can notice that they're not full demons, they're like demon human hybrids.
Yeah.
And their faces are in the opening along with the green haired woman. And we remarked in the previous episode how she could turn her hand into like a drill and whatnot. So these, I think these are some kind of demon human hybrids, or like, I'm sure we'll learn more about them. I assume they're the big bad of the season or whatever, or the, this group of them. These two are also in the opening next to her, or right above her in that opening setup. So like, clearly they're all part of a similar group. And then, as I said, they're like half human, but like parts of their bodies were demonic, so they can like transform their bodies. Maybe entirely at will, maybe only partially, we'll find out. But obviously they're in the opening and thus going to be pretty important. Along with, of course, this woman we mentioned.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I think I was just assuming they were a bunch of nobodies. But now that you mentioned that, yeah, they're more important than I thought.
In regards of the poofy-haired rooster, I just assumed it was probably like old geezer or like the sensei for the rooster fighter. But sounds pretty young and mentioned that captured rooster his father, so it looks like it's going to be like the sidekick of the show.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, just by looking at him in the opening, he looked like he might be an older guy, but yeah, it looks like as we learn, he's actually ends up being quite young. That's true.
For some reason, I thought he was kind of Russian. I don't know why. Maybe it's the crown had that kind of a big hat form shape. But I thought he would be like a Russian rooster, and so I was expecting his name to be like Slobovich or something rather than another Japanese name like Kisuke or whatever. Again, that just made me obviously judging a book by its cover or a rooster by its crown or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, kind of like BB Boy, I didn't necessarily think he'd be a geezer, but I thought he'd be like the same age as Keiji. Wires, it seems pretty clear given how things are set up that he's obviously older than Pyoko, like significantly so. He's an adult, he definitely sounds younger than Keiji or Elizabeth even.
We meet back up with our core trio, and Elizabeth is cooking up some carp, and there's just some little non-important hijinks here with the carp. Keiji tries it and he loves it. It's amazing. He's like falling over backwards how good it is, and he really wants more. And Elizabeth's made a portion for each of them, and they kind of fight over the portions, and Pyoko ends up like saying, oh, you know, Mister, you can have my portion. And of course he just, you know, selfishly takes her portion and eats it. And Elizabeth gets mad.
I do think it was pretty, I don't know, maybe it was just me, but I found this bit pretty funny because Keiji's upset that he thinks he's getting the smallest portion. And now he's the biggest guy. He's like, I'm the big guy. I deserve the big portion. Yada, yada, yada. But like Elizabeth is making clear that she, each portion she gave each person was exactly the same, and the only reason KG's portion is smaller is because he already took a bite out of it, and that's when he was claiming, oh, it's the best thing I've ever eaten, tastes like grass and frog put together or whatnot, which is obviously a compliment coming from a rooster. But he took a bite out of it, and then after taking a bite out of it, complained it was too small. And Elizabeth, of course, is like, are you fucking stupid? what the fuck's wrong with you?
He's selfish, man. He's selfish. I mean, he's not like a bad guy, but he definitely is selfish.
No, of course not. But it's just hilarious. I don't know. It's very, very stupid, but I just found it kind of hilarious.
Yeah. I liked the funny part about that to me was the reaction that he had when he tasted it. And then we get kind of like a still frame of him jumping in the air, and he's just like, oh, it's amazing. That was pretty good.
Yeah, a reaction that would not be out of home out of Food Wars, I suppose.
Yeah, Food Wars.
Technically, the food introduction was straight out of Dungeon Meshi, including like the horn and the flower, the flowing scroll.
Yeah, you're right. It totally is. Yeah, I didn't even think of that. God, I wish we got Dungeon Meshi. I know that's impossible, but that's such a good show.
It's a Netflix show, right?
Yeah, yes. It's on Netflix. Anyway, okay. Meanwhile, we cut over and we see a couple of gangster lizards who are getting who are harassing this other smaller lizard, and you know, they're giving him a rough time. And then this is when Pyoko shows up, and she's gonna be, you know, tough and be like, you jerk, stop picking on that guy. And she starts like effortlessly beating them because she's like three times their size.
Yeah, rare footage of Pyoko having a size advantage on anyone or anything.
It's pretty great, though. I kind of like it, especially some of the reaction faces she makes, because it's like these guys are all tough and they're like, oh, we're going to kick your ass, you little chicken. And then they just like are beat instantly. And she's just kind of bored, which is pretty funny. But the one that was really calling the shots there, the main one, gets really mad that he got beat by this little chick. And of course, he has one of those demon blobs on the back of his neck, and it erupts. And we get a lizard demon.
I will admit here, I was actually surprised because I didn't think non-humans could become demons. But afterwards, I remember there was that slug demon that Keiji fought like a couple episodes ago. And it seemed like that was not born from a human. It was so...
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
It makes sense that there's some like it, obviously, there are humans that can turn into demons. We've seen that multiple times. But clearly, there's also non-humans, like just, I guess, slugs and lizards and whatnot can also turn into demons as well. And so... Yeah, that took me by surprise, but thinking about it, we actually, I suppose, did see it in the past. And he got huge. He was almost, he was like building sized, like, right? I recall.
Yeah, and you're making me think now that at some point in the future, we're going to get a rooster. Probably going to happen.
I guess there's a point where we're not sure what happened to Sarah yet, where it looks like she was became part of the other demon. So that's still a question mark, though it's not a separate demon in that circumstance.
But right.
I guess there's even that might have been a hint to it as well.
Yeah. Maybe maybe as a twist, KG will sprout one or something, has to fight it. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, there's a big long sequence where, you know, the giant lizard demon is chasing them around and stuff, and they fight it and stuff. Eventually, Elizabeth saves Pyoko. But the key thing to point out here is they make a very clear here that Elizabeth noticed that, and she mentions this to Keiji, that Pyoko hasn't grown at all. They've been together for a couple of weeks now, and she should be bigger now. But there's something about Pyoko that's preventing her from growing up or getting older or maturing, I guess.
I suppose a month is technically weeks.
Yeah, I'm assuming a few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say throughout this whole back half of the episode, there's been Pyoko's kind of feeling a little bit depressed that she can't really contribute more. Like, she feels the biggest contribution she's made recently is basically giving her food to Keiji. So obviously, she gets a confidence boost beating up those lizards and whatnot, but obviously, that gets reversed when she's chased down by the monster lizard, as we saved again by Elizabeth and Keiji. So she's Pyoko's kind of in the corner or by the river, sulking. Like, I need to be saved again. I'm so sad. And of course, Elizabeth and KJ are kind of see that. She's pretty depressed and whatnot. And that's at that point, as you mentioned, that Elizabeth makes that observation that Yoko seems not to have grown, even though they've been together for over a month. Mm-hmm. And so this made me look up chicken life cycles, because I wasn't sure how old chickens usually live for and so on and so forth. And obviously, there's some variation. But what I found, and obviously maybe... I did a quick search, so maybe there might be better sources out there than what I found. Quick search, and it said on average, chickens lived about 3 to 8 years, depending on obviously the breed, how well they're cared for, so on and so forth. And that from hatching to adulthood is about 6 to 7 months. So in this circumstance, we already met Pyoko. She wasn't just newly born when we met her back with Pops. She obviously mm-hmm. must have been at least a few weeks old. And obviously, if you're reaching adult size and morphology within 6 to 7 months, and you've been traveling around with these other chickens for about a month, it would be the equivalent about, let's say you're out with a 10 or 12-year-old, and you were with them for like 2 years or 3 years, and they never grew an inch. That would be extremely weird for a human. So putting in that context and using those metaphors, and obviously my numbers might not entirely match up, I think it makes a lot more sense. Because obviously, I wasn't necessarily aware of how old chickens live for, how long it takes them to mature and whatnot. So I was saying, oh, is a month a long time for a chicken not to have grown at all? But given that short bit of research I did, and again, I did it super quickly, so maybe I wasn't using the best sources. I'll totally admit that.
You don't have to qualify everything by what you do and don't know. We get it.
Sure. But basically, I was saying Elizabeth's comments make sense with that context.
Yeah, I agree. I'm more interested in how this affects the story. So like, is this inferring that there's something special about Pyoko? Is she also going to have some kind of power like Kisuke does, or not Kisuke, but Keiji?
Well, we do know that Kisuke has a power from the next episode preview. We saw a little bit of it for a few moments. But recall that there was that moment in the last arc where...
Yeah, she had the strength. Yeah, right. That could be it. If that is it, that's pretty like benign. But I'm just curious to see where they go with this.
Also remember, we talked about this a little earlier, the green-haired woman, when she caught Pyoko and said, make sure to take care of this one. I felt to me that she was implying that something special about Pyoko. And of course, the end part of the episode's like, she's not growing normally. There's something weird with her. What's up with that?
Exactly.
So clearly, there's something. I don't know if she's a mutant or whatever, but there's something.
I'm assuming that this woman with the green eyes has a lot more knowledge about this stuff than they do. So she probably, she might be checking up on them for all we know. Why else should, maybe that wasn't a coincidence that they ran into each other, you know, that kind of thing. Be very interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah, we don't know exactly who Pyoko's parents are. Maybe she was like conceived in a lab or something. We don't know, but we'll find out soon enough, I suppose.
The last scene of this episode is that Kisuke comes running up, and you know, of course, he's been running forever. Runs into the troop, sees Keiji, and then says, "Big brother."
And of course, Keiji's stunned. "What did you say, Nani?"
Nani, he's a little brother to Keiji, and like you said, they kind of tease and kind of spoil a little bit in the preview for the next episode that Kisuke also has some kind of rooster power. So, which I think we all assumed, because I was saying a long time ago that I thought he was going to be like Vegeta or something.
Yeah, I will say, even though Kisuke calls Keiji his big brother, I would not assume that they're actually related biologically. It could definitely be big brother in in another sense, like, oh, I've heard so many stories about you, or you're my, the cousin of my father's mentor, or, something like that. I don't necessarily assume they're actually brothers. I wouldn't assume that. They could be, but I wouldn't assume that just based on this.
You're right. I mean, there's no evidence other than what he said. So we'll see. All right, well, let's talk briefly about what we thought about this episode. BB Boy, since you haven't been here for a while, why don't you go first? And you have any thoughts about this episode or anything you want to add?
The Dungeon Meshi nod was neat. I didn't expect, since that's a relatively new anime, though it's only like two years old at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it was necessarily a Dungeon Meshi nod. I think it was just a cooking... It's fun and let's do anime hijinks, which is not uncommon. So I don't know necessarily it's a Dungeon Meshi nod per se, but kind of that whole genre of cooking stuff. I guess I'll also use this as a moment to shout out Campfire Cooking for my absurd skill. It's actually a pretty fun fantasy show about an isekai guy who isn't a warrior, but kind of has a special ability that lets him buy food from this home world. And he parlays that into a big chef, and then funny things happen, but it's in the fantasy setting, and it was pretty fun, kind of relaxing show, and there's a lot of I cook stuff and look how good I cook it, and then I eat it and my friends eat it, and I just want to shout it out because I thought it was a fun show I saw recently.
Yeah, it's an isekai that doesn't suck.
Oh yeah, you saw it with me, B-Boy, so yeah, he's aware of the show as well. Yeah, so
you have anything else you want to add, Crocodile?
I thought the date at the beginning was definitely not what I expected. It kind of came out of the blue, but it was funny enough. And I thought the comedy worked pretty well in this episode. And they've also laid down a bunch of kind of like teases for the future. We're obviously seeing some of the bigger players in the story come to the forefront. We finally get the last man, the crew. So I think it was good comedy. There's some good character growth going here, as much as we can expect for a show like this. The narrative's kind of coming into play. I thought it basically did everything it needed to do and did it decently well enough.
Yeah, my thoughts are that, I'll be honest, I wasn't as hot on the whole date thing. It kind of felt random and out of left field, but I did like some of the comedic moments in it. But I definitely enjoyed the second half of the episode way more, and I thought that that was really good. I liked all of the stuff that happened in the second half. And I'm really curious to see where they go with this Kisuke character. What's he going to add to everything? So, yeah. And I don't think I was expecting him to be KG's brother. I thought he was just going to be like a kind of anti-hero rival or something. So this is interesting. We'll see where it goes. Okay. Oh, that's it for Rooster Fighter. Let's move on then to Dawn to Dawn. Dawn to Dawn, Season 2, Episode 5. We can all stay there together. So this episode's pretty much all about dealing with trying to exercise Gigi and dealing with the fact that he isn't completely exercised.
He isn't exercised at all.
Yeah, the episode begins with them doing a ritual, trying to defeat the evil eye with this kind of funny bit that kind of repeats a couple times where they keep trying and then they open up the face and then he's just like, I'm still here, you know, and they do that a couple times. My notes are a little scattered on this one. This was a difficult episode to write notes for because it was kind of all over the place. Let's not try to describe everything that happened this episode. Let's just hit the major beats because it'll take a long time because there's a lot of random things. It's something I really like about Dawn to Dawn, though. I will say, like, its narrative structure is fun. But anyway, the big beats are that everyone's at the house. They're all sharing dinner, and Ira is back, and she's with them as well. She's also like bickering with Momo, but also fawning over Okaroon, that kind of thing.
And also, don't feel a little Mantissian boy, but I would mention that she was also calling him out, like, why didn't you take me to the, why was I involved in the action? I thought, because I think we mentioned that.
Oh, yeah.
Or, so I thought, you know, obviously I already saw this all, but like, it was funny to me that she kind of even commented on the fact, like, where the fuck was she this whole time? And so
I kind of like that the story didn't actually like force include her in this because it's more realistic that she, not everyone's going to be everywhere. So I like that, but you're right. She is kind of fawning over the Mantisian's kid. The Mantisian's there. They ask him like, what's he doing? And he's kind of like, well, I'm moving to Earth. I'm going to move to Earth and live here where I'm close to milk. I need milk for my kid.
Yeah, because he said he couldn't figure out how to milk the cow they gave him, so, or something like that.
Then they kind of like accidentally sort of discover that when they splash Gigi with hot water, it kind of subdues the evil eye and Gigi returns. But then they also discover that if he gets splashed with cold water, that the evil eye takes back over, which led to a really, really great moment where Gigi starts humming the original opening song to Rama One Half, which was really great. I did not expect that.
I don't know if they kept it in Japanese, that bit. But I will say that joke flew over my head the first time just because I was not familiar with the original Rama theme. I mean, I know Rama is always famous, and influential show. I've been watching the new version by MAPPA, but I've never seen the classic version, but... So the joke went over my head the first time. I know a lot of people caught it and were like, whoa.
It's one of those, this is one of those like rare instances where I actually like caught the joke right away. Cause I was like, Rama was probably like one of the first anime I ever saw. So I was like big into it. And just the moment he starts going, ipapa, ipapa. And I was like, oh my gosh, he's got that. And it's so appropriate. Cause that's exactly, you know, true to the show as well. So.
Meanwhile, like Momo is like doing Ultraman poses all the time. And that's, flying over the cross of millions of viewers around the world.
And then they're kind of like, okay, we have to be really, really, really careful. You know, the Seiko is like, here's the deal, guys. You know, the seal is kind of coming off, but he's still very dangerous. We have to be extra careful. Everybody's got to have these hot thermoses with them at all times, just in case. Then the Mantisian says he's going to go leave now. And he said, what are we going to call you? You don't have a name. And he's like, oh, just call me Peeny Weenie. And I'm like, okay. Sure.
Not much to say about that.
That's a name.
What do you want, bro?
And then he gets in his UFO and then he flies like 10 feet in the air and then goes across the street. And apparently he's just going to live next door, which I thought was also very funny.
I think the joke hits a little harder because it's not just 10. It's like they engage their hyperdrive, seem to fly off into the distance and then just circle back, just land like 100 meters away or something. So it's just, I think Oprah himself has made the comment of they could just walk there. Why did they do all that?
There was also a lot of like Okaroon just fawning over the Mentesian and his technology. He's like, tell me, how does it work? Do you use antimatter or whatever? You know, he was saying, just like, he was just totally into it, which makes perfect sense. I mean, you're talking to a real alien.
It's not just talking to an alien, but specifically an alien who doesn't want to cut his penis off.
Yeah. Well, they go to everyone goes to the hospital to, not everyone, but the main crew goes to the hospital for Gigi because Gigi's parents are there. They're recovering. Gigi's like trying to act cool and stuff, but then he breaks down and cries when he sees his parents. And then on the ride back, there's kind of like it's a really nice scene where just Okaroon and Momo are in the back seat and Momo's just sort of like wanting to like touch his hand. And it's just sort of like, you know, flirting almost, but also being very coy about it. And he's like, what are you doing, Miss ISA? And he's just like, she's like, I'm not doing anything. What are you talking about? And then, but she's also kind of blushing. So it's a really nice kind of like young love scene there.
Engaged in the ludus of all activities, handholding.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Censored GIF.
Exactly. They should have blurred it in the episode.
Were they doing that from the hospital or on their way to the hospital? I thought it was on their way to the hospital.
I thought it was after they left. Well, I think it's after they left because, maybe it was on the way. It could have been on the way. Anyway, it doesn't matter. They were in the car. Anyway, and then like Seiko's just continuing to remind them about the importance of stuff. We then cut over and we see on the news that the Kitos have been arrested. But before we get to the commercial break, we see a very surprising scene where the main Kito woman has escaped. She's escaped and she's on the run. And then she sort of rips off her disguise, her human disguise. And then we see her true form and she says that she's a subterranean.
Dun, dun, dun.
That was cool, though. I was like, oh, that's cool. I like that.
Oh. Remember all those times you were asking me if there's something weird about the Kitos and what's up with their gray skin and yada, yada, yada?
Yeah. Well, I just thought she'd be like an alien, and she might be an alien. I'm not going to say she's not, but the fact that it's a subterranean, which is like another kind of like sort of cryptid type thing, I was like, oh, that's cool. I like that.
Well, I think she's more likely not an... I don't know if I'd call her an alien. I think she might be of Earth, but just, you know, like the mole people that are kind of, you know, everyone jokes about the mole people in every kind of, you know, whatever setting.
Well, that may be true. I'm not saying it isn't, and you probably know, but I'm just saying that, like, we've already experienced things in this show that we thought were supernatural, but then they turned out to be alien. And I'm just saying that, like, maybe this one isn't, but, you know, that wouldn't be far gone for this show to do something like that, where, like, one day they'll meet Dracula and it turns out he's just an alien, you know, or something like that. Anyway, yeah, so we see her true form. What are you going to say?
No, I mean, I was going to say, just, we don't see her for the rest of the season. So there's still, she's the hanging thread of the Kito matriarch and how much she wants to fuck a Momo is still out there.
We come back from the commercial and we have Momo and Okaroon. They're kind of just having a walk together, a walk and talk. This is where the episode gets a little weird. And again, my notes aren't going to do it justice, and let's not go too deep into it because it could spend 20 minutes on this. But the basic gist of it is that we learn that they need to use music to cure Gigi.
Hi, Ashley. Yeah.
And then it says, and then I wrote down friends show up. Who, what friends? I don't remember that.
Almost friends, because basically.
Or gal pals. Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Remember? All right.
I like those characters. I'm glad they're back. And that, I thought it was funny too that the one with the pigtails was like just hanging on Okaroon the whole time. I don't know. It was cute.
No, they like Okrun, but not a we want to take him from herself, but more like this is Momo's boy.
More like a tease, like a friendly thing. But it was just kind of like for him, it's awkward, right? Because he's like kind of nerdish and like insecure, and she's not. She's just kind of like just hanging on him. And I don't know. I thought that was fun. But yeah, those guys are back. They were on their way to school. That's why they were walking together. Then we see that Momo is going to ask Ira and Okrun to live with her. And this, of course, like Okrun is like, this is, you know, oh my gosh, you know, and then Ira is kind of like put out by this, but then she also kind of likes the idea of being close to Okrun. So it's like, yeah. And I guess, you know, there's this bit about like Ira, like, you know, I can't hang out with you. You're going to like make me look lame. But then she kind of like, I don't know. She's like matured a bit here.
There's still an awkwardness of basically Ira admitting to the entire school she framed Momo with those shitty rumors. And so there's like, what is their relationship? And then how is the whole school going to react to them hanging together? I think there's at one point where Momo comes to fetch Ira looking all buddy-buddy to take her out of her classroom and everyone sees that. And so I think everyone's like a little confused, but I guess they're thinking, oh, I guess they are friends now, or it's a little weird, but it's understandable awkwardness given what transpired back in episode 6 and 7 of the previous season.
Yeah, but I do like it. I like, though, that like even though Ira is still confrontational with Momo, she's kind of also being like, yeah, you know, she's not over the top. She's kind of like subdued, which is nice.
Yeah, she's part of the crew basically at this point. So
right.
Reluctant alliance.
Yeah. We see that Taro has now been able to come off of Gigi. That part of the seal has been broken, so Taro is now free of having to walk Gigi around. By the way, there was a funny scene at the hospital where they have to, you know, for Gigi to move around, Taro has to like puppet him, which was funny. But now that's off. But Seiko says that it's, you got to be very, very careful, and because this is a super powerful demon you have in it, more powerful than anything else, and the only reason it's even partially subdued right now is because, you know, Gigi is very skilled at he has very strong powers, so we have to be super careful. And
I think the argument from Granny was that the evil eye was basically a baby, wasn't that the issue?
He did say it was young, yeah, but it's like of a tier of demon that is like way strong, right?
Yeah, that's what Granny was saying, like the ones that are like older or more experienced or more, you know, are really dangerous, but this is a baby. So like, we're kind of able to sort of handle it, but still crazy dangerous.
Yeah. Everybody is now moving in. They're all there. They're going to have a meal together. And then we get this, the final scene is kind of funny because it's done with CG, but everyone's passing stuff around and they're kind of passing soy sauce and other things around. And then we see like a drop of it almost falls on Gigi's hand, but they miss it. Nobody notices. And then they pass it one more time and it does hit his hand. And then the episode ends when the evil eye sort of explodes out of him.
Flips the table. The house explodes. Everyone dies. Series over.
Yep. So that was this episode of Don to Don. I think the thing I love most about Don to Don is that it is very irreverent and different, and it's not like any show I've seen before. And in that way, it is very good. I enjoyed it.
Only thing I might want to add is that the reason that Momo asks Ira and Okrun to move in with her was basically for protection and to make sure to handle Evil Eye. I feel it's probably important to mention why she did that, because it's obviously a big ask, so just want to throw that out there.
That's true. I think I might have missed that. I assumed it had something to do with the Gigi predicament.
Yeah, just it's better like they're all there. If shit goes south, it's better they're all there than rather than have to call, hey, Okrun, Evil Eye's blowing up the place. Can you come over? And they'll all be there. Like, you know, okay, Okrun is pretty fast, but Ira might take a while. But still, it makes sense to have everyone there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, BB Boy, we haven't talked to you since Don to Don's been on the block. What's your thoughts on this show? I don't want to assume. What do you think?
It's a cool down episode.
Yeah.
New things are being established here and there. So,
have you seen this before? Is this new?
It's funny. I've watched the anime. Like, can I keep forgetting some details here and there? Since it's kind of less remember cool down episodes.
Okay.
I also read the manga, so I know things. So
yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of in the dark about it. I think Seda is too. So yeah, it's all new to me. It's pretty cool though. I mean, there's a couple of things through cultural osmosis that I've picked up accidentally, but on the whole, I it's all kind of new. So I'm enjoying it very much. I think it's a good show. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of the best around.
Oh yeah, well, it's definitely, in my opinion, it's the best show on Toonami right now.
Oh, that well, but I mean, that ain't a hard thing to. I had a hard thing to do right now. So.
Yeah, good point. Especially when we're going to talk about the next two shows. So let's go into it. Let's talk about the next show on the block, which is Blue Lock. Blue Lock episode 12, the second selection.
Just before you go deep into Blue Lock, I want to say that this episode didn't necessarily clear up what we were talking about last week, but I did get a chance to listen to last week's episode, and then, okay, thankfully, that was cleared up in terms of, yeah, like, I guess the dub messed up, but what Ego explained didn't make sense with what I was seeing, what Sato was seeing, but then also, I guess you guys went on to Reddit to find out what was actually going on. And so it feels hard to me that dub would mess up that badly. I kind of want to watch it in Japanese to see if the explanation was also kind of nonsensical. But
yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It could very well be just poorly written in general. But yeah, we finally figured out that there were five team Zs, five team Ws, you know, that kind of thing. So it was confusing. Anyway, the episode begins and we see Isaki walking into this big empty room, and then Ego summons this sort of hologram that's going to be a goalie, and Isaki has to hit this ball past this artificial goalie, which he names Blue Lock Man. So, yeah.
Ego names them, not Isaki, but yeah.
Yeah, Ego. Yeah, my bad. So anyway, yeah, this is cringy to me because they kind of explain that apparently there's a microchip in the soccer ball, which allows the hologram to somehow stop the ball, which is absolutely in any respect, yeah, not an explanation.
Yeah. Thank you. Cause I was listening to this. I was thinking to myself, this is bullshit. I call bullshit. No, I disagree. No, like you,
this is a 1,000,000% bullshit. If they could do what they were doing in this episode, they would have basically, Ego would have invented the holodeck from Star Trek The Next Generation. But that's not what they're saying here. What they're saying is, and the only word they use is microchip. So they're saying there's a microchip in the ball. It doesn't explain how the ball suddenly loses its inertia or changes direction or anything. Right.
The microchip, unless it's like, are they saying they're little like jets in the ball that let it move? Like, it's defined physics.
No, unfortunately, they do not say that. They don't give you any indication of why this is working. They just say it's science and it's bad.
I like how they say that they basically bankrupt themselves buying this tech. And I'm thinking to myself, if you have this kind of tech, there must be better things to do with it than train Japanese teenagers. Like you said, they invented the holodeck, or not they, whoever they bought it from invented the holodeck. Are you seriously saying this is the best you can do with the fucking holodeck? What are we doing here? Oh, and I refuse. No, my sister's disbelief is destroyed. I reject this premise. I reject everything about this.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, so the rules are that Isaki has to hit 100 goals in 90 minutes, and it's just, he kind of just does this, but he ends up throughout doing it, it gets harder and harder. And he kind of realizes that this is just forcing him to up his game, literally. I wrote down microchips, question mark, which is stupid. And then Henri and Ego watch Isagi and they talk. And I thought it was funny, too, that Henri mentions that because Ego had purchased this magical microchip tech for these holograms, that they're actually out of money, that they spent all their budget on this, apparently.
I mean, honestly, it would have made more sense if they just said, if Ego just said nanomachine son, if to the explanation, that would probably work better than whatever the fuck they were trying to say here. And that would still been a bullshit because, you know.
Nanomachines striker.
I thought Blue Lock Man was a dude in a Pepsi Man suit or like the Blue Man group suit. I thought it was a dude in a suit until they did their explanation, and I thought to myself, the dude in a suit would have made more sense.
Yes. Oh yeah. Or robots or anything. Yeah. Holograms. What? and then they make hologram like guards that are like two dimensional. They're more like obstacles, but these somehow block the ball too. Because again, apparently the ball has a microchip, guys. That microchip, man, that's a powerful technology. Anyway, yeah, he gets a max level. He gets the max level, and it's very, very hard. But he's loving it. Isaki is loving this. He's kind of getting a little drunk on the high of being good, and he's just like, "Oh, this is amazing." And then I wrote down he passes.
Yeah, he made 100 goals in a 90-minute time limit, and so you can move on to the next
the test. I'm sorry, I thought yeah. For some reason I was thinking he passed the ball. No, he passed the test. Yes, he passed the test. He walks into the next room, and he learns that the next room is going to be the third stage, and the third stage is going to be teams of three. Okay, and when we come back from the commercial, Bachira shows up, and he's like, "Hey, I want to team up with you, Isagi. Let's team up." Nagi and Ryo are there, but then Nagi's like, "No, I'm going to team up with these two, Ryo. See ya." This is devastates Ryo.
Ryo has just jilted lover look all over his face.
Yep.
I guess Nagi's logic makes sense that these guys booked his ass, so he wants to figure out what the fuck would happen. So I think his logic makes sense, but Ryo's, it's as if someone just handed him divorce papers. He was not handling it well.
Yeah. The other team that's forming next to them is led by this guy named Rin Itoshi, who is apparently the younger brother of a very, very powerful player or something. And in parentheses, I wrote down, it's Sasuke. This guy is Sasuke.
Oh, and I guess this older brother that we met earlier in the series would be Itachi. Is that how it goes?
That's my guess. But I mean, there's like, this guy's super coded to be just, it's like, you could just, it's Sasuke. Ego tells them that there's a special rule about how this is going to work is if your team wins, then you get the opportunity to take one of the opponents that you fought to be on your next four-man team. And that the non-picked people on the losing team are out. They're going to be disqualified from Blue Lock. And then he also goes on to say that it's going to be like teams of three, then teams of four, then teams of five.
I do think there's a last chance with the teams of two compete against another team of two. And I think then if you're in a losing team on that point, then you're knocked out forever. But I do think you can lose once, go down a two-man team, and still have a chance to rebuild back up.
Everybody gets new ranking numbers. They're much lower than they were before, of course, because, well, I guess not because, but just the numbers they weren't real before. Now they have real numbers.
Well, technically, aren't the numbers, well, they're now less than 250 people, so obviously the numbers have to go down. But there were technically that many people before. It was just the rankings past like 220 didn't mean anything because everyone thought they were in the lowest ranking. Right. So
it's yeah, I would assume there were four other people with the same number of Isagi when we started.
Yeah.
So anyway, they all have real numbers now, basically. Yeah. And I don't remember what it was. It was in the double digits, but I don't remember. Anyway, the episode ends out and Isagi says he wants to battle Rin. He wants to take on Rin Itoshi. Like, so the main takeaway I'm getting from this episode is that Isagi is like becoming like power hungry. I guess is a way to put it. Like he's just,
yeah. His monster wants a challenge. He wants to like, because basically if they win, they can take the, as you said, take the one of the opposing players. So he wants to beat the number one team, take the number one player and just like, oh, I'm going to be so amazing. I'm going to take the number one guy. I assume he's going to get his ass pushed in and then probably lose Nagi. That's my assumption. I don't know. That's probably what I assume was going to happen. And it probably makes it convenient that Nagi joined the team rather than someone else from Team Z getting snatched away. So, but we'll see. But yeah, his monster is hungry and is yearning for a challenge.
Yep. And that's this episode of Blue Lock. Yeah, I don't know. yeah.
Oh, one other thing I mentioned is that the number three guy on the other team that they saw in that that final room is so ridiculous in like an anime tropey way. He's like, oh, I'm so nervous. Oh, we're going to lose. Oh, and dude's rank number three. And I'm thinking to myself, this is not how normal people act. Like, this is also an anime, but this is a little too anime for me. The guy with like giant eyes, like, he's like the, like, what are lemurs that have giant eyes? Or what other primate I'm thinking of? Inhumanly large eyes. And he was just kind of screaming about, oh, we're going to lose. Oh, we can't take risks. And I'm just saying, chill your anime trope ass down, dude. Shut up. You're being fucking annoying. Quit it. I don't know why. That just bothered me. That was just really, it was kind of tropey in a bad way. But like, not to say people can't have doubts or insecurities or whatnot. All of that's part of all of us, even the most confident of people. But that was too much.
Yeah, agreed. And I think it's all because it's going to lead to like the realization when he's suddenly like amazing. You know what I mean? He's going to, he's probably the trope where it's like, I'm not going to do it very good. I'm going to lose. This is horrible. And then he suddenly is out on the field and like killing it. You know, that's my guess. Cause how else is he number three? Right.
Right.
All right. Anything else about this episode? Anybody? I mean, I think that's all I got. Nanomachine, son.
Yeah. A better explanation than what we got.
It would have been. Yeah. Or we see like Data step out from a doorway. He says end program and the holodeck stops. Okay. Blue Lock continues to be goofy. Let's move on to Tokyo Revengers. Tokyo Revengers, episode 12, Revenge. Yes. Now this is a pretty dark episode. I think we all knew it was coming. All right. Starts out, Naoto is taking, it starts out with a really long, like, recap. I'm skipping that. We get to the interesting part where there's a new story, which is Naoto is taking Takemichi to see Hina. I was very curious. Was Hina going to be weird? Was it going to be a weird future or alternate timeline? No, she's just a school teacher, apparently, like super sweet. Anyway, he runs into her. I thought
you were going to be like a prostitute or something, right? That's what I heard.
I was like, what if they go real weird and dark and like she's like a prostitute or like she's out on her luck or down on her luck or something, or she's in the gang?
It would have been funny if like she was the leader of Tomon now for some reason. Like, how the fuck would that happen? Who knows? That would have been funny.
You know what? If they ever did that, that would be actually pretty cool. But they won't. Anyway, Takemichi continues to suck. He's like the weakest part of this show, unfortunately. And he does so because he gets nervous and he doesn't want to. He ends up running into her, and then he keeps telling himself, "Oh my God, she's an adult."
Like, I would hope so. Like,
are you an idiot? What are you talking about? Oh, yes, she's an adult.
I will
say, you know what year it is, right?
I will say it does kind of highlight a kind of creepy aspect of the show that's kind of hand wave in the fact that when Takemichi's back with Hina in the past, he has an adult mind, but she doesn't. And so I think that's part of the disconnect for him, but it's also highlighting that he's kind of making out with his girlfriend in the past, but she's still a child and he's like,
wow,
not a child anymore, and that's kind of all weird. And
I agree with you, except for the fact that Takemichi has the mind of a child, even as an adult.
You're saying it's so stupid that it's kind of like a child anyway. Yeah. I guess you can kind of make that point, but
anyway,
there's some weird stuff going on there,
but it's weird. But anyway, yeah, he sees her, and of course, he does what he does, which is he cries. They go back inside, they're both very nervous. You know, they're kind of shy and stuff. And then he does another thing, which makes me like, I was just like, I wanted to bang my head against the wall where he sees the necklace he gave her. And he's like, is that necklace? I've seen that necklace. Is that the necklace? Is that can't be the necklace I gave her. And I'm like, what are you an idiot? Are you a moron? What are you? Yes, why would you be surprised that she has a necklace?
I think I saw you make the joke that he thought maybe aliens gave it to her or something.
Yeah, I'm like, what do you think happened? It's just, why are they making him so dumb?
I will say there's kind of a line you can tread, because I think part of, so basically Naoto's taking Takemichi and Mihina, and then when you're about to reach an apartment, that's when Takemichi was like, turns around like, oh, I don't need to do this, I can't do this, I don't get, you know, she doesn't need to see me, I'm just happy she's safe, and that's when he runs away, and then that's when he bumps into Hina, as you mentioned, so he's kind of nervous, kind of maybe feeling he doesn't deserve this, he just wants to make sure she's safe, like, there's a line to tread where it can be, you don't want it for him to be necessarily too overconfident and be like, yeah, I saved the woman, give me my prize. Like, that's weird and like way not as
personal. I'm okay with him being nervous. I don't like that he's right. Stupid.
Right. They take it too far. There's a balance. He's not a macho man. He's not nonchalant. Can't just, oh, I time travel and save the woman, whatever. I don't care. You can't play it too cool, but you don't want to play it so nervous that he's having a mental breakdown that's just, as you saying, bordering on stupidity as opposed to just like genuine nervousness. They take it too far is what's going on. There's a line of tread and they walk over and then whatever.
Yeah, I just don't understand why. I mean, outside of the fact that they're trying to, the author must be trying to make Takemichi like a good guy, nice guy kind of character. But like, if I was reading this or as I'm watching this, I'm just thinking to myself, it's like, I want someone who, he doesn't have to be like super awesome, but he has to have some level of competency in how he reacts to situations. And just to see him like have to struggle so hard to figure out the most basic logical things is just like, it's hard to watch. Like, I just can't get over like the, when he was like surprised and or confused by the necklace that she's wearing, which he gave to her from his point of view, like hours ago.
Yeah, like he should have just asked her, like, oh, I see you have the Nexus. Is that the one I gave you?
Exactly.
That would have been a good icebreaker. Like, they were trying to break the ice. They were, like, staring at each other for, like, a good while. And I think now I was getting pissed that they're just not talking. That would have been a good icebreaker. Hey, that necklace, is that the one I gave you? And boom, you go from there.
Or even, you know what? Even if it's okay, make him nervous about it. Be like, oh, my God. The necklace I gave her, she's still wearing it. Does she have feelings for me? Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. No, it's not that. It's wait, is she wearing a necklace? What is that necklace? I think I've seen that necklace. What are you? Yes.
Is the one I gave her? No, can't possibly. And I'll end it can't the conversation.
Be. And like he spends parts of the episode literally like trying to get a look at it. He's like, is that the necklace? No, it just happens to be another fork leaf clover necklace that just happens to look like the one you gave to her in this critical moment in your life.
He's like a man trying to look at a woman's cleavage who he's never met before, but like, rather, but that's not the situation at all. It's just a fucking necklace. Just ask her. You're like, you know, yeah. Just ask her. You're adults. You can be nervous. It's weird. Fine. That's normal, but just, you can still just talk like a human.
Why was he trying to hide it? He was being so like, I got to look at it, but I can't let her see that I'm looking. What? Why? Yeah, anyway.
I can only say the only thing that makes sense maybe to me is that since it's still really early in the narrative, the author's setting this up here so that we're in like 100, 200 chapters, whatever, we can be thinking to ourselves, wow, Takemichi sure has grown as a character. Look at that character growth. It's so impressive. Maybe. That's my only hope. That's my only hope. That's the only thing that can salvage this, but that's going to be way different.
Yeah, that could be it. Okay, we come back to the commercial break. They go on a walk, and Hina lets Takemichi know that 12 years ago on Christmas that she was dumped by her boyfriend. And, of course, it's Takemichi. And of course, he has no memory of this, which is a little weird. I don't want to go too much into this, but that's weird. I guess it makes sense time travel-wise, so he doesn't remember this, but that happened to him. So, yeah.
I just can't. This is a man who, as far as you know, has had no other girlfriend since Hinata. He's not like a player who just like trades women on a dime. Like, this is the only love he's had in his life. He remembers her fondly enough that when he heard about her death at the beginning of the series, he was really, you know, talk about it. Like, he still cares for her. Like, there's no way you don't remember dumping your first and only.
No, yeah, I get what you're saying, but here's the thing, Crocodile. Because of the time travel nature, he has no memory of the events that occurred. And I also believe that this is a setup for future events where he's going to be forced to dump her to save her or something like that. That's my guess. in a weird way, he traveled through time. So it's like he still has memories of his former life. He doesn't automatically inherit his alternate timeline memories.
Maybe in the original timeline, he never dumped her, but in the new timeline he created with his actions, he did end up dumping her, but he hasn't lived through that yet, so he doesn't remember it, is what you're suspecting?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't think he'd ever dumped her on Christmas before, is what I'm thinking.
Okay, but now in this new timeline where she lives to at least this point in time, things changed in the past that he hasn't lived through yet. And I guess I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. He could be that dumb that he forgot that he did this, but I wouldn't put it past him. But I'm going to go with the side that I think that's an event that didn't occur to him originally. I think so.
Okay, fair enough. We're giving a smidge of credit.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they start to get kind of close, and he runs away. He's like, I got to go to the bathroom. So he runs away, leaves her there. And he's like, I'll meet you in the car. And he runs to the bathroom and he kind of like to wash his face or whatever and kind of get his courage up or something. And as he's leaving, he runs into none other than Hanma, the adult Hanma. And Hanma is there and he's like, huh, well, this sucks. This would have been a lot easier if you were in the car. And then he just walks away. And then, of course... Oh, I shouldn't say of course, because Takemichi's kind of dumb. But he figures out that he's like, oh no, there's something bad's going to happen. So he goes running to where Hina is, and he sees a car, and we see the car crash into hers and smacks into it. He runs up and he sees that it's none other than Akun was the driver, and Akun, as he's dying, says, and I am with a little bit with. Takemichi here is like, why did you do this? You were a hairdresser. Things were going so great for you. And he's like, no, you don't understand. Everybody who is in Tomon has to obey Kisugi. We all have to obey him.
He's still in the gang, or at least still the gang has dominion over him in some fashion. I was not sure how that works exactly. But I mean, you saw Hanma, who was part of not Tomon, he was part of the Valkyrie gang, or whatever it's called. But I guess he got absorbed into Tomon at some point. Because it's clear that Hanma told Akun to do this. So obviously Hama is now working for Tomon, or the new Tomon, who's, you know, whoever the leader of that is. But it's clear what's going on here. They still have some hold over Akun somehow. And so.
Yeah. And so he goes to the car to see if, you know, what the condition of Hina is. And we see that she's been sort of stabbed in the midsection, that she's likely
impaled by a steering column.
Yeah, she's impaled. She's practically bisected, practically. And they have a brief moment, and he's like, "I vow, I'm gonna change things. I'm gonna protect you." And then the car explodes.
He says specifically he's gonna become the leader of Tomon because he figures that's the only way to make sure this doesn't happen. Because he obviously like did a lot of stuff in the past, saved Draken. He, as far as he was concerned, he fixed everything, and obviously he not lived for more time. But he figures that the only way to make sure double, triple, quadruple, make sure she lives is become leader of Tomon, and then he can order or not order hits and so on and so forth. So
yeah, that's the end of the episode. As we predicted, things were going too well, and so yeah, Hinata's dead, Akun is dead. Apparently, Hanma or Kisugi or whoever is in charge.
Oh, that's Hanma's not Kisugi. They're definitely two different people. So.
Yeah, and we're going to have to go do some more time traveling. That's the episode.
I'm surprised, glanced over how Hina died or how it was depicted, because this is the actual turning point of the show where it ends up being time for some attempt of quality. This just stops here, because from here on out, like, prepare to just be a full-on hate watch.
Really?
I've been quiet about this for the longest time, since, you know, this is like, yeah, this is the only good portion. Like, yeah, I was also having a similar experience my first watch. I was kind of like this, okay, I'm kind of like this, ebb and flow. But this moment, the stupidity, you know, just stood there, gawking at somebody who was about to run her over, and without any indication that time is slowing down. No. Or she's just accepted. No, she's just shocked at what's happening and just sits there.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, anyone else who would like to stay alive, just leave the fuck out. Instead of, the storyteller just gave up.
It would have been better if they had, like, put a bomb on the car or something that she couldn't react to. But to have her just sit there and watch it happen and, yeah. I mean, I get it. She's not, like, a gang member, but...
There's a billion better ideas that could have. And I could also describe that to every single episode from here on out.
Really?
Where there's a billion other better ideas they've could have conceived. You know, at this point, you'll see.
Okay. Well, I'm going to brace myself then because I was, like I said, you're right. I think earlier on, I wasn't that bad down on the show. I actually, for a while there, I was kind of liking it more than Blue Lock. I think I still kind of do. But Takemichi lately has really rubbed me the wrong way. And mostly because of like the bad decisions and the bad storytelling around his character.
Oh, baby, this is just the beginning.
All right.
This is like, this is the nightmare I, like, survived.
Okay.
Where I'm legit felt like Peter Parker in that image where, no, don't change the channel. I'm not just liking it. I'm just liking it.
All right. Well, we'll see where this goes then. I'm sure we're going back to time and to continue.
You just have to accept it, Zonic. This is how it's going to be.
I guess I will say I don't really blame Hinata for jumping out of the car as soon as she noticed the impending hitman. I feel like that doesn't seem too unrealistic to me, just because jumping out of a car with a quick reaction time is kind of easier thing to say you can do than to actually do. And also getting frozen when you see a car oncoming towards you. Like, people get hit by cars and they don't necessarily adeptly just jump out of the way. Sometimes they see it coming and they get hit. That I didn't really have a problem with that so much. I did think it was kind of hilarious how she gets hit by the car, it explodes, she gets bicycled by the steering wheel, she gets like 5 to 10 minutes to say I love you to Takemichi, and then of course the first explosion, Takemichi comes to try to come to her aid. The first explosion knocks him back, he gets back up, goes to her, and then she pushes him out of the car. It explodes again, just to maybe double tap her, make sure she's extra dead, atomize all her molecules. There's no coming back from this. There's no nurse or doctors putting her back together. She's just like dust in the wind at this point. I thought it was pretty hilarious. That's kind of literally over the top. I don't know if that was necessarily bad writing. I thought it was kind of hilarious over the top how she was atomized like that. so the death scene was funny in that way.
They made an official t-shirt out of this scene. Straight up. Like, wow. This. At this point, it's like just, okay, unexpectedly crash into it, or even like time in like mere seconds. No, you have the character just definitely waited enough seconds to make a flight or flight decision.
Yeah, she didn't have flight or flight. Now, I'm also with Crocodile that like the gang members are all hardened criminal people, and they're probably on, you know, they're always like kind of suspicious of things and stuff. And I think Hinata in this show is very much depicted as like very, I don't know how you describe her, but like, you know, like
she's a normal adult woman. She's not
normal
a ninja
person.
She's not a spy.
She's not thinking about things like that. So
I am not giving this show the benefit of the doubt on that.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, I will agree that I find it frustrating, but not that particular moment, but I find the whole concept frustrating. And here's, I'll take it a step further, BB Boy. And I said this earlier in this season too. And here's what they'll never do. I don't know, cause I haven't seen this, but I promise you this, here's what they will never do. They won't have Takemichi go back in time, grab Hinata, and then them just leave, like just leave and go to like France where they're going to be safe. I bet they won't do that, which would be the likely solution, right? The easy solution.
I mean, being a 14-year-old with no money, I think it's kind of hard to move to a foreign country.
I don't know. I mean, if you know you're going to die, maybe it's worth going on the run. You know, I'm just saying.
Well, to me, the annoying parts of this episode where, as you described, Sequel, everything with Takemichi and his personality and his thought process. So they were just overwrought, and I think they turned the dial up on the nervousness and stupidity too high. Like, you want some nervousness, some awkwardness, that makes sense, but they just turned the dial up to like 12, and it was ridiculous. Yeah. That was, I think, the obnoxious part of the episode. I don't expect Hinata to have ninja reflexes. People getting hit like that doesn't really bother me. The whole like double tap explosion, that was ridiculous. That was hilarious and that was ridiculous. But her, I guess, not jumping out of the car in the 2 seconds, I don't really fault an average normal teacher for not having ninja reflexes. I agree with that.
Although I will also, I kind of agree. I'm like in the middle, because I agree with you, Crocodile, but I also kind of agree with BB Boy that there was a shot where she just watched the car come at her, and I kind of thought, and also I'm a viewer because I know what's going to happen, but she didn't know what was going to happen. But as a viewer, it was frustrating to watch her just look in the rearview mirror and just wait for it to happen. And I was like, oh, okay. Anyway.
I also say one last thing is that, I just wanted this last point.
Go ahead.
I also watched a season, and we talked about it earlier in the year. I actually feel like I've forgotten quite a bit about what's going on, but I do remember, I think, telling you that my general vibe about how I remember the whole season playing out was that it was kind of not great. I don't recall it necessarily dropping off a huge cliff in the back half, but as I said, I remember me being left with an overall not very high impression. So I'll leave you with that, but I definitely want to make sure you make up your own mind. But that's just my general recollection of how I felt after watching it all, even if I can't remember all the details. I'm not saying it's an abomination of the show, but kind of like, is how I remember feeling after the end of it.
Before we move on, I know there's 24 episodes in this season. Is there like a second season and a third season, or is it just this one season?
No, there are two more seasons of, I think, 13 episodes each about.
Okay.
I've not seen them. I don't know if BB Boy has, but I have not seen the additional seasons. But there's more of this. I will say, though, the licensing was a little different. I think Disney had the second and third season, so there may be a chance that might be a problem with Toonami. I mean, we got Bleach, but it could be getting seasons 2 and 3 of this might be a little trickier for Toonami. I don't know. But there's definitely more of this after the season.
All right. Well, that is Tokyo Revengers, the revenge. They got their revenge, I guess, by killing Hinata? Okay.
Well, they're trying to kill Takemichi. They just fucked up. So, but now it's Takemichi's turn to get revenge.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah, she was just a bystander. All right. Well, let's move on then to the final premiere this week, One Piece. One Piece, episode 774, a battle to defend Zoe, Luffy, and Zunisha. So, like we saw in the last episode, Luffy and Momonosuke are cringing and are in pain because they're hearing this loud voice. Pedro mentions that both Roger and Odin both also heard a strange voice when they were at Zoe. And Momo then sort of gets like this vision in his head. He can see that it's Jack and the Beast Pirates that are attacking Zunisha.
You can see through Zunisha's eyes, right? That's what's happening, basically.
It's not that he has extrasensory perception, it's that Zunisha is showing him that. And that's when Momo finally realizes, it's the island itself. It's Zoe that's speaking to us. That all happens in the first half of the episode. That's basically it. In the second half, Zunisha has like a monologue with Luffy and Momo and kind of says that, well, mostly Momo, I guess, and is saying that like a long time ago that Zunisha had committed a crime, and that the elephant was punishment was that it was supposed to roam the seas forever.
I'm thinking to myself, what is the legal institution that has authority to arrest, indict, convict, and sentence an elephant that is large as an island? How does that work?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. But it says that also another stipulation was that part of its punishment is that it was not allowed to fight back, that it can't do that. It's not allowed to. And then it's pleading with Momonosuke to give it permission to fight. Unfortunately, Momo this whole episode, and like all most episodes, is just whiny. And he's just like, I don't know what to do.
I mean, Toei's trying to stretch this episode out for 30 minutes or 22 minutes, so.
Yeah, it gets a little worse, I guess, because of that. And Luffy, being Luffy, he's kind of like, hey, I'm tired of your whining, punk. You should just do it. Just tell him. You need to man up. And so he does. Momonosuke yells to Zunisha and says, yes, you have my permission. Defend yourself. And then we get this really long sequence where Zunisha lifts its trunk and then eventually hits the Jack ships, destroying them. It's very, very drawn out. And that little ape, that little monkey says that Zunisha ape-radicated the ships. And then goes running back to the minks and everybody and lets them know that Zunisha ape-radicated them. And that's, you know, everything stops shaking. And yeah, everything seems to be okay now. And Luffy immediately is like, hey, let's get some food. We're going to leave. And then I guess the most interesting part of the episode is that they kind of cut away from Zo for a moment. And we see, meanwhile, in some snowy place, we hear that Kaido is on the phone and he's on the transponder snail and he is angry to learn that Jack has failed. And there's some couple of other characters there. I don't know if you picked out who they were.
No, I probably missed that. I guess I assume they're in Wano. I don't know if they're in Wano, but I assume they're in Wano, right?
No, there were two other characters shown in this scene that you would have seen before. Would you like me to point them out, or would you rather be a mystery? No,
point them out. I'm not gonna go back and try to watch episodes. Point them out.
You okay with that, BB Boy? I don't know if you've seen this.
I did, but I oddly don't remember.
Okay, so we see someone laying in a like jail cell.
Oh,
Doflamingo? Was that Doflamingo?
No, it's not Doflamingo. Yeah. No, no, it's not. Oh,
shoot. Maybe I'm thinking of a different jail cells.
No, this was somebody that was knocked out. They had been defeated, and all you see were his pants. But if you're familiar with One Piece characters, you would recognize that those are the pants of Eustace Kidd. And then also, the person he's talking to on the transponder snail, you can see who that person is based on what the transponder snail looks like, and that is Scratchman Apu. That's who he's talking to.
Oh, okay. Those are two of the Worst Generation, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that just the musician, right?
Yeah, yeah, the guy that's like the guy with the long arms. Yeah.
Hey, with the keyboard teeth or whatever?
Yep, that's him. That's who he was talking to. Yeah. Cause again, the transponder snail looks like who he's talking to, and that looks just like Apu. So
I mean I guess that's a mystery for us to figure out eventually. But it's interesting that they'd be speaking to Kaido, I guess.
Exactly. So anyway, that was just like an Oda drop, like an Oda info drop in that scene where it's like, oh, there's something else going on somewhere else. Let's see what it is. And it's vague, but you get a little information. It's like, where is this? We know it's Kaido because they say Ebb's name. It's on the phone.
We can see his face. We saw Kaido's face.
They did show it. Yeah, they did show his face. But then like who was in the jail cell? Well, if you look at it, you can tell who it is. And who's on the transponder snail? Well, if you know the voice and you can see the transponder snail's face with the piano teeth, yeah, you know who it is. Anyway, that's it. Zunisha fought back and defeated Jack.
Oh,
and yeah.
Okay, so last episode, Jack was saying our cannonballs can injure Zunisha because he's so old. I'm thinking to myself, Zunisha is the size of an island. Your little dicky cannonballs, I think the scale difference would be larger than a human and an ant. Like, these cannonballs should not be hurting Zunisha even if he's old as hell. I don't buy that. I also don't buy that, okay, so Zunisha, or sentenced, who's being forced by God knows who, can't defend himself? Really? He's just supposed to let himself get killed? He could have he knocked out Jack in like a nanosecond. Oh, okay, not a nanosecond because it's Toei. So it was like 5 minutes, but in real time it was like,
yeah,
it was an instant hit, a one hit KO basically.
Right.
And so like nothing. I don't buy that Zunisha is threatened by Jack. I don't buy that Zunisha is being has had a sentence enforced by some entity that won't allow it to just do basic self-defense. Because not only is it protecting itself, it's protecting its inhabitants. Like, obviously, we don't want a giant elephant just on a rampage doing shit. That's obviously bad. But if someone's trying to murder you, you can be knocked them away. What Zunisha did is not that disruptive to the general ecosystem. He was just defending himself from murder. And then if Momo and Luffy weren't there, his psychic signals would have gone out to no one, I guess. And then so he just would have been murdered. And then so
yeah, Jack's plan. And it's not like, so, okay, let me answer your questions real quick. So first, I totally agree with you. The cannonball should not affect Zunisha. I don't buy that. I think the story wants you to buy that. I don't buy it. I do believe that's what the story, I really do believe that's what's happening, but I think it's lame. I don't think you're right. It'd be like an almost a molecule is hitting you, you know, like it's not going to do anything, but we're supposed to believe that it's hurting Zunisha. So just go with that. Unfortunately, there's no better answer for that. However, whether Zunisha fights back or not, it's not so much that someone is like forcing Zunisha to obey these rules. Think of it differently. It could be more along the lines that Zunisha refuses to act without being told to.
I can't think of pacifist, but not to the point where you'll get murdered.
Well, I don't think Zunisha cares if it dies, but the Zunisha doesn't want to die because there are people on its back. It's more like that.
Well, yeah, it should.
Zunisha did say several times, it's like, hurry, hurry, do it, or you know, you're all at risk. You know, it's not so much that it cares that it's died. It's more that it doesn't want other people to die.
Well, either it's self-preservation as an animal or just a living creature, or the preservation of its inhabitants or like the people living on it. Either way, I think it's a perfectly valid reason not to ever make an initial attack. But if someone's literally trying to murder you and like succeeding mm-hmm. somehow, regardless if that should work or not, I think it's fine to be like, hey, dude, stop.
Oh, I agree. I agree with you that is hard to bite, or that's a hard pill to swallow. But I think that's the reason. I think the reason is that Zunisha doesn't feel like it has the authority to strike. And
so
maybe out of guilt, maybe out of responsibility or something.
Wait, this isn't by some magical restriction or something?
No, I think it's more like, I don't know this. To be clear, because I don't want to spoil anything, and I literally don't know. But from what I understand, what I think, my own personal take on this situation is that Zunisha totally could act, but is choosing not to because it is either guilty, feels guilty, or doesn't feel worthy, or whatever reason, doesn't want to take a life or something, and it can only act when it's told to. By someone with authority, and Momonosuke being the son of Odin would give it that authority.
I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you not to spoil the answer, but I was just going to ask you if they explain what crime the elephant committed, who arrested, indicted, convicted, sentenced, the whole shebang. Do they ever, I was going to ask if they ever explained that, not to say what it was the answer, but if they explain that in the future, but it seems like you don't know.
I don't know.
Okay, because I'm curious what the whole deal of the elephant is, because this is kind of, I could assume it's like Oda setting something up in the future, because this seems pretty extreme. How the hell do you capture an elephant and then, put it under sentence and this whole thing? And all of a sudden, I assume why Luffy and Momonosuke can hear this and no one else will be explained sometime in the future. Like, obviously, Luffy and Momonosuke are not related by blood or something, so it's not genetics thing or whatever. It's some other reason they can hear this. I assume that will be explained in the future, right? At least? I'm asking you to spoil what the explanation is. Just ask if it will be explained why Luffy and Momonosuke can hear this.
Kinda, yeah, I would say, like, kinda. I think eventually come to understand why but it's not like clear why, but it's more like, oh, okay, I get it. I'm not going to go into much more than that. But the fact that Luffy and Momo can hear this, yes, that gets explained to a certain degree. I don't believe unless I miss something, and keep in mind, I did skip parts of Wano and stuff. So who knows? But, I don't remember ever learning why Zunisha is being forced to do this. I don't think that's ever been revealed. That could be something from the Void Century that's not been revealed yet.
Fair enough. I mean, Zunisha will be old enough, so that makes sense, I suppose.
Yeah, but yeah. That's fair like enough. It's over 1,000 years old, so yeah. All right. So that's One Piece. That's One Piece. We're about two episodes away from the end of this arc.
I think I heard you mention there was like filler, and then there was there was something canon for a little bit, and then filler, and then they're on Whole Cake. So it's a Whole Cake, excuse me. So it's probably like a few months still till we get there, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. So two more episodes, and then we get a three episode canon, like meanwhile, somewhere else. And then we get three anime only filler arc, and then we're into the next arc.
Is that arc the Return of Bill, and then he's brought with Puzzle Film or something?
No, it's not Return of Bill. I think this little anime filler arc is actually kind of all right. I wouldn't say it's like amazing or anything, but it's like it's okay. It's all right. It's definitely not like Bill level crap. It's actually kind of fun. And that is it for the rundown. Do you guys want to do any flavor alerts this week?
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
The only things that came to my mind are, I don't know, since you mentioned we were doing episodes, would Rooster Fighter, the previous episode, count, or is that not? I think we agreed that was maybe the strongest episode of the series so far, but I don't know if that is strong enough to get a nomination.
Refresh my memory.
There's one, the end of the dam arc, where obviously there was KG and Momo, not KG and Morio tried to save the city from the dam breaking. This whole thing that KG goes through, the redemption of the YouTuber, and we see Morio. We thought he died, then he lives, then he gets killed by the woman, and then Elizabeth realizes she loved KG. That whole shebang.
BB Boy, what are your thoughts? Do you think that would qualify?
Sure, I guess.
Okay. I mean, we can put it on there. I would say that if a better episode comes along, maybe we should swap it out.
Okay. I mean, I was curious if that people felt that was maybe worthy. And then obviously, I hope at least the best is yet to come for Rooster Fighter, because we always want shows to get better. So, but that struck out to my mind as like, oh, if we're doing nominating episodes, that might be worth it. Or, you know, because it was the strongest episode of the show so far, I think we agree at least.
Let me add that then. And then while I'm doing that, any other things you'd like to nominate this week that you think really stood out? And it could be good or bad too. So
is the Momo and Okarun handholding moment worthy of anything?
That's pretty good. Yeah, I don't know. Do I think that was a great, let me look at what we have there already. I don't know. I don't know if I would go as far as to say it was the best moment. I think it was a good moment though, but I don't know if I would.
That's fair. I just brought it up because it came to mind, but that's fair.
Okay. One second here. Keep thinking while I look something up here.
Is Takamichi being obnoxious twat like bad moment this episode?
Well, he's already been nominated as worst character.
Okay, so we're just wrapping that up in there. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. I think that's where we're gonna put that, because you're right, it's just more of the same with him. He wasn't that bad when we started the show, but he's gotten pretty bad.
I'm sure he'll have his good moments. There probably are good moments, I just don't remember. But, you know, I assume he'll probably have some good moments to balance out the bad.
No.
No, incorrect. I mean, again, as I said, my
BB Boy, have you seen the whole, like, all 24 episodes?
Yes.
Okay. Speaking from experience. Okay.
Yeah, I just my memory is a little hazy on some of those details. So, like, again, my general recollection was a violent meh, but like, I'm just having a little trouble remembering some of the details. So,
you know, this show would be helped a lot if it actually looked really good, but it doesn't look really good either, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was thinking to myself that how We don't get the full opening for Rooster Fighter because Dandadan and Tokyo Revengers both get their full openings. It's just a wild contrast. Dandadan's opening and then Tokyo Revengers opening. And it's clear one group really fucking tried, one group did not.
Oh, yeah. Do you know, or Seacolor, or those who never watched it before, do you know why there are bright lights in the opening and or endings, or whenever there were, the gangs were in black uniforms?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the only thing I know about is, like, I know that there's shots of, like, Takamichi wearing, like, a more advanced uniform, and I'm assuming that's just because he goes up, he, like, rises up in the ranks or something.
Because they're blurring out Buddha swastikas.
Oh, I see what you mean. That's bright lights that are blurring out. Oh, interesting. Okay, like imagery.
Okay. Very understandable for American broadcasting.
Oh, so they have the swastika symbol that everyone in the world associates with Nazis, which didn't originate with the Nazis, is what you're saying.
Right, like the manji is like, I guess it's not, the swastika is the flipped version of the manji. And so like the manji is still considered totally normal in Japan. Since it's so close to the swastika, just when you're releasing internationally, rather than try to explain it, you just like censor to blur it out.
I will say that they must have done a pretty good job because I didn't notice. I didn't notice they had blurred it. I'm going to look for it now, though.
Oh, my God.
Where does it appear, though? Like, does it appear on their, like, backs or...
Whatever, backs, legs, or...
It's like their symbol? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's a symbol.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've never noticed.
Yeah, Toma is part of the Tokyo Manji gang, so that's where it comes from.
Okay. Yeah, no, I didn't know that. I didn't even pick up on that. I'll be curious to see if Seda has picked up on it next week.
I think another bit of trivia, I'm trying to remember, but I'm pretty sure the opening theme song of Tokyo Revengers isn't called Crybaby?
It's called Crybaby. I did know that.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, I was just wondering if you had picked up on that. So.
Yeah, I did. Because he's a crybaby. All right. I don't think anything else is particularly jumping out to us as far as awards.
Oh, I will say Tina's death is worst moment, straight up.
So you're just talking about her like lack of reaction. Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know what exactly moment exactly qualifies, because I kind of just view it as scene or even a particular moment. I mean, the whole darn thing just ugh.
What do you think, Crocodile? You want to add this?
I don't think it's a bad. I think it's funny, but I don't think it's like this makes me mad. It just makes me laugh.
Makes you laugh,
which
he double tapped her,
the opposite of what that scene tried to do, because it definitely was designed to try to make the viewer like anguish while being in the moment, instead of like, and all it does is takes the viewer out of it.
We'll go ahead and add it for now, and just we can discuss it later when we get closer to the awards and stuff. But so I'm gonna call this
Hina's cargo boom.
Hina's cargo boom. Yeah. Okay.
I'm still laughing about it. He double tapped her with explosions. Funny.
What do you mean when you say that? I don't follow you.
Okay. So what happened? Like, Hina gets hit by the car. All right. There's like, you know, the car crunches. There's like, gas leaking all over the place. And so Takamichi. Man, imagine if Okurun was in the show. He would be. He's not a stud, but he would be running laps. Okay,
oh,
running
yeah.
laps is a little funny because he has super speed powers, but you know what I mean. Okurun is the better way to write the loser, quote-unquote, archetype. Okurun is a baller. Like, Okurun's a good guy. Anyway, Takamichi runs up to the crash. He goes to talks to Akun. Akun's explaining this whole ordeal. There's gas all over the place. One of the wires goes off, and everything sets on fire and explodes. And so Takamichi's knocked back. And he gets back up, he dusts himself off, he's barely phased, he goes to speak to Hina, and then, like, everything's on fire, she's been pale, they have their long chat, Hina pushes him, like, says, I love you, then pushes him out, then the car explodes again! And that's, like, to make sure she's extra dead, that's the double-top explosion I mean.
Oh, okay, I see.
I thought that was funny. They wanted to make sure her molecules were atomized. She is ashes. And when the wind blows, those ashes be scattered across the field. They want no part of her.
It frustrated me that he didn't try to get her to escape until I thought, well, if he moved her, she'd probably die instantly.
No, like, no, she was impaled. There was no moving. There was no pulling her out of her car.
But he didn't even try. That's all. That was frustrating me. Maybe he knew it was impossible, and I'll give it a pass for that. But in the moment, I thought he didn't even think about it. Like, he didn't think to try to get her out.
He looked at her, and she noticed that she was impaled. Like, you can't
remove
her part of her body, but then there's no lower part, and then she's going to just bleed out as her organs fall on the ground. Like,
it reminded me, I'm going to do a deep cut. It reminded me of the scene from the movie Signs, M. Night Shyamalan's movie Signs. There was a similar situation where a person was in a car crash and they were only alive because they were pinned against a tree. And if they moved the car, they'd die instantly. And I kind of thought, oh, this is probably that.
Yeah, like the organs would fall out and they'd instantly blood loss and shock. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, it's not a great scene. I'm fine with putting it in worst moment for now. It's a frustrating. I'm more frustrated by just in general because it's not a scene, but I'm just more frustrated by the ineptitude of our protagonist in this show. He just seems like he's slow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's why he's on worst character. So that makes sense. So yeah,
I worst agree. Character. Yeah. And there are characters in the show I do like. So. Yeah, it's not like I hate the show completely. I mean, I think that the two main Tomon guys are actually not bad.
And Mikey Jokin are fine. I mean, not that his first herself is, I think, a totally good character. Like, she's probably the only female character that matters, but which is maybe a diamond short.
Well, she's also, maybe with the exception of Draken, she's the most mature character of anyone in this show. But, yeah.
Even back when she was a teenager, I would say she was pretty, had a good head on her shoulders.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's going to do it then for this episode of the Toonami Escape Podcast. Thank you very much for being here, BB Boy.
No problem.
Thank you for being here, Crocodile.
Pleasure.
And until next time, later.